Good afternoon. Let's go ahead and get started. This is a meeting of the Title Setting Board pursuant to Article 40 of Title I, Colorado Revised Statutes. The time is 2:02 p.m. The date is May 2nd, 2007. We're meeting in the Secretary of State's Blue Spruce Conference Room, 1700 Broadway, Suite 270, Denver, Colorado. The title setting board today consists of the following. My name is Bill Hobbs. I'm Deputy Secretary of State, representing Secretary of State Mike Kaufman. To my right is Dan Domenico, Solicitor General, here on behalf of Attorney General John Southers. To my left is Sharon Eubanks, Deputy Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services, who is the designee of the Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services, Charlie Pike. To my far left is Maury Kneiser, Deputy Attorney General, who represents the title board. And to my far right is Ceci Gomez of the Secretary of State's office. Let me talk just a little bit about procedures. There is a sign-up sheet on the table by the back door for anybody who wishes to testify. This is a recorded meeting, and it is broadcast over the Internet as well. When the board considers an initiative for the first time, there are basically three steps that the board follows. First, the board members may wish to ask questions of the proponents. This is for purposes of understanding the proposal, which is important both for purposes of determining whether the measure complies with single subject and as far as determining a fair statement for the title. So after asking questions, the second step is for the board to determine if it has jurisdiction, and that necessarily requires the board to determine if the measure comprises a single subject. Then if the board does determine that it has jurisdiction to set a title, then the third step is to work on a title for the measure. The board works from a staff-prepared draft, which is on the table by the back door. There's actually, for each measure, there is a title and then the title in the form of a question. They're identical except for the fact that the second version is in the form of a question. Typically, the board works off just the first portion, and any changes the board makes to the staff draft on the first portion will be made to the title in the form of a question, in other words, the second portion as well. Generally, we take testimony first and then vote as a board. A decision is reached by two of the three members of the board. Anybody who is dissatisfied with the decision of the board may file a motion for rehearing with the Secretary of State within seven calendar days of today's meeting. And, of course, we're not concerned with the merits of any proposal, but simply with the setting of fair and proper titles. So with that, let's turn to, I'd actually like to take the first two agenda items together. We'll have to act on them separately, but because the first two are so similar and are basically different versions of the same proposal from the same proponents, then I'd like to start with both of them together, at least for purposes of the board understanding the measure. So if we could hear first from the proponents, whoever is representing the proponents, Mr. Ramey, if you did introduce yes. yourself, please.
I am, and I would note for the board that I'm sort of on my own this year. Ms. Wickersham is not here with me, so we'll do our best. Matt Samuelson, however, is and the proponents are here. I think what I'll do, I've got a couple comments with regard to draft titles. But perhaps first I'll just ask if the board has any questions for us.
Okay. Are there questions of Mr. Ramey about the about number 13 and number 14?
I do.
Ms. Eubanks.
Mr. Ramey, I'm looking at the sort of the versions that you filed with the Secretary of State that show the changes between the versions that you filed with the title board versus the versions that were submitted for review and comment.
Yes.
And there's quite a few changes. I just want to make sure that all of these changes were done in response to questions posed during the review and comment hearings.
They were. I think virtually every one is reflected in some fashion or another in the written memorandum from Legislative Legal Services and Ledge Council. There may be a couple things that came up during a discussion. I can think of well, actually, I can't think of any at this point, but every change that was made is reflective of a discussion that was had in response to a question at the review and comment hearing.
And in terms of one of the changes that was made, I believe, to both of them, is in terms of the imposition of the tax itself in subsection 2, it now talks about that the tax is going to be levied, collected, and paid for all or any part of each taxable year commencing on or after January 1st, 2008. And it's the part about any part of any taxable year commencing. So I'm not sure I quite understand. Severance tax, at least my understanding, is paid on a yearly basis. Their tax year may commence at different times. It's not like personal income tax where it's all January 1st through December 31st. But in terms of the imposition of this tax for 2007 tax year, if any part of that year encompasses January 1st, 2008 or thereafter, then the production after that date is subject to the new tax, or all the production during the year, or?
No, here's, Ms. Eubanks, let me try to explain how we got to that. When we initially went to Legislative Council, the words all or any part of were not present. It was our understanding erroneously that taxable year was distinguished from fiscal year, as I think in our more common experience. In other words, a taxable year would commence January 1, irrespective of when the fiscal year commenced. We have learned since that is not the case with regard to this tax, and taxable year apparently coincides with the fiscal year and can vary from company to company. Our intent, in response to that question being raised by at the review and comment hearing, is to pick up under the new tax and the new formula as opposed to and in lieu of the old formula as of January 1, 2008, irrespective of where we are in anybody's taxable year. So there's a no retroactive application of this tax upon anything that goes on prior to January 1. But come January 1, the new formula kicks in at that point. And any part of it, if a tax year begins in September of 07, September, October, November, will be under the present statutory formula. In January of 08, it will switch to the new.
But would it be fair to say that for someone who's extracting oil and gas, that if their severance tax year runs January 1st of 2007 through December 31st of 2007, their 2007 tax year, they're going to be subject to the tax as it currently exists. Whereas if you have someone else who is extracting oil and gas whose 2007 tax year commences July 1st, 2007, until June 30th, 2008, the income for half of their tax year is going to be taxed subject to this new tax.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's exactly correct.
Go ahead.
I have a separate question if you're done with
go ahead.
Subject. I'm curious what the intent is, how broadly you intend this provision to affect in 2B, allowing the General Assembly to increase the tax rate. Is that intended to mean this exempts the severance tax from Tabor for all time, every change is exempt, or that the General Assembly can change it, but that would still be subject to Tabor's requirements, assuming it applies?
That was a question discussed at some length at the review and comment hearing. And the answer that is on the record before them, and I repeat it here, is that it's different with 13 than 14. The intention with regard to 13, as stated at review and comment, is to exempt, to bring the entire new tax out of Tabor. This is a constitutional amendment. We'd be proceeding under the thesis of the later controls the former, the more specific controls the general. And that the General Assembly would therefore, under number 13, be able to go forward and increase the rate above the minimum rate established in 13 without going back to a vote of the people. It would be a tax completely removed and exempt from Tabor. With regard to 14, that is not the intent. The intent with regard to 14 is that if the General Assembly does wish to increase the rate, it would have to go back to an appropriate Tabor vote. Wording is similar.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm representing you, Mr. Domenico, is a statement of legislative intent.
No, and it makes sense and fits with the wording, I think.
Mr. Ramey, what other differences are there between the two proposals that should be pointed out?
Mr. Hobbs, I think the only other difference is the distribution formula for the proceeds from the tax at the end. I'm keeping an eye on my my sponsors and proponents over here in case I misstate something, but they're nodding affirmatively, so in unison, so that is correct.
13 has...
excuse me? 13... I'm just reminded by Mr. Samuelson that number 13 has item 7, which is the General Assembly may enact an exemption for oil and gas wells of minimum production levels, and I had forgotten that that provision does not appear in 14. There is currently such a provision in the statutory section, and we're allowing in 13 that the General Assembly may enact such.
Are there other questions for Mr. Ramey? If not, let's move to consideration of whether the measure complies with the single subject requirement. And Mr. Ramey, do you have any comments about that first? I'll see if there's others that wish to testify on that issue, but do you have any general remarks?
Well, let me state, if I may, just for the board's consumption, the single subject has been stated at the review and comment hearing. Because this is certainly what's in our mind, and I'll give it word for word as we stated it there, and that is that the purpose or subject of both of these initiatives is to adopt a new severance tax upon income attributable to the sale of oil and gas and dedicate the revenues produced therefrom. That would be our statement of the subject. I think it is a single subject, but I would encourage the board, following up on discussions that we had in years past on similar initiatives, to please bring out any concerns the board may, or others may have with regard to that. But I do think it does represent a single subject.
Thank you. Mr. Gallagher, do you want to comment on the single subject issue?
Yes, I do. Thank you.
And if you'll identify yourself for the record and who you represent, please.
My name is Sean Gallagher from Hogan & Hartz, and I represent the Colorado Oil and Gas Association. And I am anxious to be heard this afternoon on the topic of single subject, because we believe that this board lacks jurisdiction to consider this amendment or this proposed initiative because it violates the single subject rule. As you know, Colorado law is very clear that proposed initiatives must be limited to a single subject that is clearly expressed in its title. And initiatives violate the single subject requirement if they relate to more than one subject and have at least two separate and distinct purposes that are not unrelated, that are not related to each other. There are two reasons for this rule that the Supreme Court has articulated. One seeks to avoid the practice of log rolling or grouping together multiple subjects for the purpose of enlisting support for one measure and using that support to further additional unrelated measures. And the second reason, and it's an equally important reason, is to prevent surprise and fraud from being practiced upon the voters. There are a number of cases, as all of you know well, that have addressed this single subject issue. In one case, In Re Ballot Title and Submission Clause for and Summary for 1997-1988, number 84, the Supreme Court concluded that an initiative that both provided for tax cuts and imposed single mandatory limits on state spending violated the single subject requirement. Similarly, in In Re Title pertaining to proposed initiative Public Rights in Waters 2, the court held that an initiative that would adopt the public trust doctrine for the state's waters and would require the Water Conservancy and Conservation Districts to hold elections for certain actions violated the single subject rule. Here, the severance tax initiatives, both 13 and 14, all contain provisions that violate the single subject requirement because both provisions have multiple central purposes. They create a constitutionally based severance tax upon income derived from mineral extraction. They eliminate a statutory-based severance tax. They also eliminate the ad valorem tax credit. They provide for exemption from certain revenues from Tabor, and they impose a requirement upon the legislature that those tax revenues be spent or allocated in a specific measure. Each of the two measures, 13 and 14, are similar in this regard. They only differ as to how they apportion the revenues. It's important to note that especially the apportionment of revenues section is not merely an implementation or an enforcement detail or mechanism. The Supreme Court has found where initiatives contain a provision that simply enforces or implements the primary provisions of the initiative, that those satisfy the single subject rule. That is not the case here. I don't think anyone can say with a straight face that the provisions that allocate or earmark funds that would be generated as a result of these initiatives go to a certain pool within the state budget. I don't think anybody can suggest with a straight face that that is an enforcement mechanism or an implementation mechanism. It's really a completely separate earmarking of funds that has nothing whatsoever to do with the primary purpose of the measure, which is to alter the severance tax provisions and eliminate the ad valorem tax credit. So for those reasons, we believe that both proposed initiatives, 13 and 14, fail the single subject test, and therefore this committee lacks jurisdiction to render an opinion on them.
Questions for Mr. Gallagher? Ms. Eubanks?
Mr. Gallagher, under your argument regarding the allocation of the revenues that would be generated by the severance tax, would you be making the same argument that there would never be a single subject for an initiative that imposes a new tax but then specifies what it's supposed to be spent on?
Well, I guess I would have to look at each particular initiative to render an opinion on it. And certainly there is a continuum where some measures may be closer to the single subject rule than others. And I don't want to speculate as to where a particular proposal would fall in that continuum. I think it's clear that these two proposals, though, aren't anywhere in that gray area. They are, I think, because they're trying to accomplish two very different things within the same initiative, I think it clearly violates a single subject rule.
Mr. Domenico?
Without having to resort to hypotheticals, these two actually, on that point, are quite different, it seems to me. Do you see any distinction? I mean, the 13, right, has 25% to counties and municipalities impacted by energy development, whereas 14 has kind of a long list of a variety of things. I take it you don't see any significant difference between those two, but it seems to me that there may be a significant difference in that 13, at least, the portion that's dedicated, I mean, I take it, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is if there were no such provision in these, the money would just go into general revenues. So the only difference between that and 13 is this 25% directed towards communities that are directly impacted. That at least seems arguably related to the subject of the severance tax and what we do about the costs imposed and the revenue the state can garner from oil and gas activity. So why is there no significant difference between the two on that point?
Well, because it's sort of like being a little bit pregnant. I think the fact that Initiative 13 eliminates or changes the severance tax formula, eliminates the ad valorem tax credit, and then earmarks that money to a particular revenue is coming from that to a particular source. It's doing really three different things. I think severance tax modification is one topic, elimination of the ad valorem tax is a second topic, and then earmarking revenues to whatever source is a total third topic.
So that sounds like the answer to Ms. Eubanks' question then is yes. That you would, in fact, think that any time there's a new tax imposed, that if it tries to dedicate the revenues from that tax to any purpose, it violates single subject.
Well, I'm not going to say any time. I think in this situation it clearly does. And what I would point out with regard to 13 is I think there are a number of things that violate the single subject rule. It's not just the fact that there's an earmark for a particular stream of revenue that's contained in 13 that I think violates the single subject rule. I think it's also the fact that the ad valorem tax credit is eliminated in this initiative. That is not necessarily in directly related to elimination of the statutorily based severance tax. I mean, we're mixing constitutional tax issues with statutory tax issues, and I think for that reason it violates the single subject. So I don't want the board to get hung up on the fact that the proponents very, very wisely have tried to earmark a portion of these revenues to non-renewable or to counties and municipalities that may be impacted by alterations in the severance tax. I don't want this committee to be beguiled by that fact. I think there are a number of reasons why 13 violates the single subject rule, and that simply is but one of them.
And Mr. Gallagher, I'm having a little trouble understanding part of that, in that to the extent that the measure deals with replacing the severance tax, it seems like, you know, part of that could be specifying the percentage, I think there's a $300,000 exemption, and the first $300,000 is exempt. It seemed like the measure could deal with credits or create other credits. It doesn't, I don't think. But it seems like all of those are things that relate just to the calculation of the severance tax. It's hard for me to understand why those are different and distinct subjects.
Well, I think, you know, it would be a completely different bill if there was, or completely different initiative if there was no attempt to earmark the revenues. So I guess in answer to what I understand your question is, could the an elimination of the statutory based severance tax along with elimination of the ad valorem tax credit and imposition of a severance tax as part of the Constitution, could that in and of itself satisfy the single subject rule? And I don't want to offer an opinion as to that hypothetical today, because that's not the case. I think each time you take one step farther down the road away from the core purpose of this sort of initiative, you run that much more danger that you violate the single subject rule. And clearly the totality of what's trying to be accomplished here in a single initiative, I think, violates a single subject rule. And I think you have to look no farther than the the proposed title that the board will consider if it concludes that it has jurisdiction, because that title informs the voters that this measure is trying to do a number of things, not necessarily related to a single purpose.
And on that point, I'm glad you brought that up. The board is required in the title to clearly express the single subject. And in the staff draft, don't want to get into the staff draft necessarily, except that the staff draft articulation of that is concerning the tax on oil and gas extracted in the state. And it seemed like arguably at least everything in the measure does deal with that. I think I hear you saying, but there's different components that constitute different subjects. But is that not a fair statement of a single subject for 13 and 14?
Well, I think the clear test articulated by the Colorado Supreme Court is whether, especially the earmarking of a revenue stream as a result of the elimination of the ad valorem tax, is something that is consistent with the central purpose of 13. And we don't believe that it is consistent with the central purpose of 13. It is a completely different policy decision as to where that money goes. You eliminate the ad valorem tax credit, you create a stream of revenues. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's the natural and probable consequence of that the money flows to the counties and municipalities like the proponents suggest. I think that's a completely separate policy decision that they've made. And because we're talking about two completely different policy decisions, which are for two separate and distinct purposes, we believe under the Supreme Court test that this Measure 13 does not satisfy the single subject rule.
And can I ask, this sort of follows up on the other questions from the other board members, I think. And with respect to number 13, as Mr. Domenico pointed out, it simply allocates 25% to, economic impact, social economic impacts, and then 75% for whatever the General Assembly determines. If that first allocation were not there, and it simply said, for any purposes the General Assembly authorized, would that be a separate subject?
You know, that again is a hypothetical question, and I don't want to answer a hypothetical because I don't know what position my client would take in the event that that initiative was proposed. But I think it's that we're talking about, if for lack of a better analogy, an on-off switch. I mean, the very fact that that provision is in there and it earmarks a certain portion of this revenue to a certain purpose flips the on-off switch. And if you flip the on switch, it's not a matter of the degree to which it's flipped. Once it's flipped, it creates a second subject for this initiative, and for that reason, we believe it violates the single subject rule.
And maybe one other question. You noted that one of the purposes of the single subject rule is to protect against surprise and fraud. And maybe you've done this, but can you kind of articulate to me what features would be surprising to a voter that they would not expect in a measure that concerns the tax on severance taxes?
Certainly, and I don't mean to suggest that the proponents are trying to propound a fraud on the people of the state of Colorado. I don't have any reason to believe that's the case. But I do believe that a voter reading through the ballot title, it is a significant feature of both 13 and 14 that they earmark either some or all of the revenues to particular purposes. I mean, that is a critical portion of this measure. Yet the average voter reading through the ballot title wouldn't learn that until they read the last clause in the ballot title, the proposed ballot title that was drafted by drafted for comment here today. It is, in for lack of a better term, really sort of an afterthought in that title description, when I think in reality earmarking a portion of these revenues is a core feature of this proposed initiative, and that's exactly why the Colorado Supreme Court would say they should be set out in two or more separate ballot title or ballot initiatives. It is because of that very reason. I mean, that is a major decision for the voters of this state to make a determination about where a stream of revenue goes, and for that provision to be buried, for lack of a better description, in the middle of a very long ballot title and also in the middle of a very long initiative, I don't think gives fair notice to the voters of Colorado exactly what's going on here.
Other questions for Mr. Gallagher? Thank you. I'd like to give Mr. Ramey a chance to reply, but is there anybody else who wishes to testify on the question of whether the measures comply with the single subject requirement? If not, then Mr. Ramey, would you like to reply?
I would briefly, Mr. Hubbs. Thank you. And you know, I think Mr. Gallagher has raised a very important proposition. I think Mr. Domenico's question sort of goes into the same thing that I would like to flesh out in terms of adoption of new taxes. Virtually everything that's in here is an aspect of the tax that we are attempting to adopt. A lot of the focus in the discussion we just had has been is to what extent, if at all, can we dedicate the revenues from, in terms of the uses of the revenues from the source from the tax that we're creating. I would offer the proposition, and I want to bring the board perhaps a little unfairly back to a discussion that we had 1 year ago on a similar measure, because I think it poses Mr. Domenico's question quite well as well. Number one, we can take the position that if we adopt a new tax, all that we are permitted to do consistent with a single subject requirement is dump the revenues into the general till, the general fund of the state. I'm not aware of anything that Supreme Court has ever said to suggest that, but that certainly is one position that could be taken. If we go beyond that, that we have a single subject problem. Then we go into the area of, well, if we start specifying uses, if we say we're going to create this tax and here's what we want the revenues used for, and I'm addressing this particularly to Mr. Domenico in responding to his question, how far can we go in that regard? Can we designate a use, 2 or 3, 30? I mean, is there a line? Now, last year, and I'm going to suggest I don't think so, but I would solicit the board's, you know, concerns in that regard. I think that it would be consistent, I would represent, it would be consistent with the single subject requirement, though I don't think there's any case dead on point on this issue on either side, but I think it would be consistent that if we have a single source of revenue, we can specify its uses, no matter how few or how many, and if it's just a general fund, that's fine. If it's more and it's more particularized, that's fine. Now, an issue came up last year, and it was from Mr. Domenico, as I recall, that what if we go down to a second level? And that is we create a source of revenue, we specify the uses, and then we go down some in the context of some use that we specified, and we tell whoever is administering that use what they can do. And to me, that poses a different level question, and it was the determination of this board in connection with an initiative last year on a 2-3 vote that, or 2-1 vote, that would pose a single subject problem. Now, you're not seeing that here. We have simply one level of specification, though, as you've indicated, in one of the initiatives, only two, general fund being one of them, and in the other, a number of different uses. And I think it's important that we sort of flesh out what this board's view of compliance with single subject requires. I would propose to the board that I think the consistent with the general guidance that we've gotten from the Supreme Court, that a single source of revenue dedicated to multiple uses constitutes, as far as my statement goes, a single subject. Similarly, I could switch it around. If we had a single use, we could probably generate funding for that use from multiple sources of revenue. Now, I'm not going to go so far as to say we can have multiple taxes adopted in a single initiative and then have multiple uses of those funds. That is likely, I would suggest, to pose a single subject requirement. But doing what we're doing here, a single tax, and stating how we want the revenue from that tax to be allocated, should be, I would submit to the board, a single subject. I solicit your opposition to that, if there is any concern with that, so we can straighten it out. But I think otherwise you get yourself into a position, I think, or we're in a position where we can adopt taxes, but we, for no purpose. We can't adopt taxes and designate how we want the money to be used. Or we can designate a use, but we can't designate the source of the revenue that's going to fund it. I hope that that commentary makes sense, and I'm gratified this subject is before the panel, because I think that is something that we all need to get our arms around. What we've tried to do here is avoid the concern of last year of secondary level allocations. We have one source of revenue and one layer of multiple uses in both initiatives.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Ramey? Ms. Eubanks.
Ramey, if you could refresh my memory about, because there were, I remember there were multiple filings last year. And
only a few.
and I know that they involved the federal mineral lease monies, and they also involved severance tax, or
yes.
Was it? Okay.
There were so many versions, I'm beginning to forget them, but there were a number of them that also allocated the federal mineral lease revenues that's not present.
Okay. In terms of how those measures were structured, that once you identified your particular revenue sources, I mean, my recollection is that you had them, the funding, go to multiple purposes, some of which were education-related, but I don't know if all of them were. I mean,
they in some cases they were not.
Can you?
And I can't remember how we specified them. I do remember that there was little concern. I hope my memory is accurate with the board. There may or may not have been concern from the objectors, but there certainly wasn't much concern from the board, if any, with regard to the fact that there might have been different kinds of uses for the single stream of revenue. Where we did run into a difficulty, and this goes back to Mr. Domenico. I don't mean to pick on Mr. Domenico, but he was
I'm getting used to it.
He was the board member who posed the question last year, well, what happens when we designate one of these uses out of five or six or three or however many, and then we start directing the recipient of the funds there, not only to use the money as we've indicated, but also to send 15%, to apply 15% to this use, and then 12% to this, and 50% to this, at a secondary level of allocation. And I think the board's vote at the time was, yeah, when we get into multiple tier allocations, then we do perhaps run up against a single subject requirement. I'm not going to accept the argument, but I think that was certainly the decision of the board.
But the title board did set titles for some of your
measures. Not on that one.
No, but on, we did set titles, yes, on some of your measures, and did those measures contain multiple purposes for which,
yes,
those monies were spent?
There were so many varieties, but yes, Ms. Eubanks.
Okay, thank you.
I have a handful of questions. I think what I recall the...
I hope I recalled you correctly.
I think so, and... I think the issue was it dedicated money similar to 14, some percentage to the education fund, but then also sort of sought to adjust the way the education fund is allocated, and I think that was where my real main problem came from with that. So I think you've accurately characterized it. I have a couple of questions. The ad valorem tax credit issue. Forgive my ignorance of the ad valorem tax structure in the state, but the current statutory structure has a fairly complicated ad valorem tax credit system in it, right?
Yes.
And so my question is, if you simply repealed the current statute and replace without this subsection 3, does that mean there would be no ad valorem tax credit? Because, or is there some other source of a credit besides what's in 3929105 that you're concerned about repealing as well?
Well, if I understand your question, Mr. Domenico, we're repealing the old tax.
Right.
With it obviously goes the credit, because the tax would be there. What we're attempting to assure here as we adopt a new tax is that such a credit cannot be resurrected to be applied to this tax. And
okay.
The only credit I'm aware of, if there is another, I'm not aware of it, the only ad valorem credit I'm aware of that applies to the severance tax is, in fact, the one that you're referring to that appears in the current statutory structure.
Okay, good. I guess my I think I may make it a habit this year on the title board until I figure out what to make of this, to ask proponents to explain to me how the Supreme Court's decision in number 55 last year, which was the that was the initiative regarding services for illegal immigrants, which essentially said that there were two purposes that were unrelated and incongruous. One, decreasing taxpayer expenditures for
persons not
lawfully present, and the other, restricting access to services. And so they sort of, the Supreme Court seemed to be saying, when there's both kind of a substantive restriction that you're trying to impose and a funding restriction, that's a violation of single subject. And I wonder, is this not, why is this not, I guess is the question to ask, why is this not the flip of that when you have both a something substantive you're trying to promote, here this funds for certain areas, as well as the fiscal tax issue. And it's certainly not directly on point, but the Supreme Court in that case seemed to take a fairly strict view of single subject, and I'm trying to get a handle on how strict we should be interpreting it, how strictly.
You know, Mr. Domenico, I wish I'd known you were going to ask that question. I would have reread Supreme Court's opinion in that case. And I don't think I can competently address at this point what the Supreme Court intended to do with regard to that, with all due respect to my law partner who was involved in that case. I'm not sure what sense to draw or not to draw out of it. Perhaps Mr. Gallagher could do better. I don't know. But let me try to posture it this way. My sense of the Supreme Court's rulings that I recall, the only other opinion that I recall particularly coming down last year, which had a single subject issue, was a across-the-board Tabor revision initiative, as I recall. The Supreme Court does not appear to have evidenced a wish to overly constrict the concept of single subject. I know I'm not answering your question, but I haven't reread that opinion, and I can't give you a response directly on point that might distinguish those two opinions, but the two situations. But let me pose it this way. If you take the position that we cannot, that the single subject requirement prevents us from creating a source of revenue and at least at a single level dedicating its uses, that would pretty much eviscerate the ability to, or the whole purpose of creating a source of revenue to accomplish a fiscal purpose. I mean, the reason that we want to create a source of revenue is not just to go after the oil and gas industry. I suppose that might be somebody's goal, but it's not ours. Our goal is to create a stream of revenue that we can use for a variety of purposes, and we're trying to do it in a way that reflects responsible public policy without excessive detail. I think it would be inappropriate to read whatever guidance the Supreme Court has given us in other opinions to say that that would violate the single subject requirement. I mean, it takes away the whole ability to engage in this kind of activity, other than just to create a tax to create a tax. And we don't want to create a tax to create a tax.
And I'm not sure it would have been much more helpful if you had just finished reading the Supreme Court's opinion, frankly. Just,
don't
it's difficult. Half the point of my asking these about it is because it's just a difficult opinion, in my opinion, to understand how, in fact, if we were to apply it as it seems to be applied, it wouldn't have the effect that you say it would. which is to almost make it impossible to approve anything. So,
no argument.
Next time, you'll be prepared because I'm going to ask again.
Well, I will be back and I will have read that.
But I guess my last question is, in 13, you told me part of the way you intend it to be read is to exempt this tax from Tabor. Is that not a separate purpose from what you told us was the goal here, which is to establish a new tax and dedicate the revenues?
I don't think so. And I understand the argument, but I don't think it is. I think we are creating a tax, and we can establish the bells and whistles for the tax that we're trying to create as we want to. For this particular one, we're saying that one component of it is that it is de-Taborized, not subject to Tabor. And the other one, we're not saying that. So increases in the rate would be subject to Tabor. It's just an element of the tax. I think we can do it either way. I think we need to be clear about it in the title. If you permit us to go ahead and establish a title for this, but if you find jurisdiction, I do want to address that in the title to 13, because I think the title needs to be clear about that and isn't, I would submit at present under the staff draft. But I see no reason why we can't. It's just an element of the tax that we're creating.
Thank you, Mr. Ramey. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on the question of whether number 13 and 14 comply with the single subject requirement? If not, I'll turn to board discussion or a motion. Ms. Eubanks?
I think that both proposed initiatives 13 and 14 contain single subject. I think that all of the provisions of the measures are related to one subject in terms of being a severance tax. They all relate. I mean, it makes sense to me that if you have a new tax, even though it's imposed by the Constitution, that they're getting rid of the current statutory tax, which also eliminates the ad valorem tax credit against the statutory tax. They're prohibiting such a credit from being established against this constitutional tax to exempt the revenues from Tabor. To me, that's related. I think that's similar to what was done, say, with Amendment 35 on the tobacco tax. One of their provisions was to take that out of the scope of Tabor. In terms of the apportionment of the revenues, I think we've set titles before on measures that had multiple purposes for which new revenues created by initiative were to be spent. And so I'm very comfortable in concluding that these two measures contain a single subject, and I believe the board should proceed in setting a title.
Any other discussion, Mr. DiMenico?
I have to handle these one at a time, I'm afraid. I'm not smart enough to compass them together. I think I'm satisfied with that the ad valorem issue does not create a single subject problem. For 13, I'm comfortable. I'm certainly comfortable that the simple fact that there's some direction on how to use the revenues is not a problem, especially when the only direction that's in there is connected and interrelated with the where the tax is coming from. The only thing that's holding me back a little bit on number 13 is not even the exempting it from Tabor's revenue limits, but allowing the General Assembly to raise the tax rate completely exempt from Tabor. And I would like to get a little more discussion from the experts up here why they think that's not a problem, because I'm That's the last thing holding me back, and I'm not quite sure where to go on that one.
Can I, with respect to the number 13, the way I was looking at it is that the measure did not need to specify a starting percentage at all. I mean, it could have simply replaced the existing severance tax with a tax at a rate to be determined by the General Assembly and have that, and I was assuming, have that that setting of the rate by the General Assembly to be not requiring a separate vote. In other words, the approval of this measure would be voter approval. Now, maybe I'm wrong about that, but if that were true, then the fact that the measure has an initial 5% rate would not change the result for me.
I would agree with that. I wonder, though, about changing it at a later date if that's not different in a significant way, and I'm just not quite there yet. I guess because under your scenario, the voters would be saying, all right, we're approving here this one time the General Assembly setting a tax rate, but that to me doesn't necessarily imply that they're forever allowing the tax rate to be set by the General Assembly without voter participation. And so doesn't quite get me there.
And maybe one potential flaw in that reasoning on my part is that I don't know what we would do as far as Tabor compliance setting the amount of the tax increase, but maybe I'm wrong in the premise that you could not have simply a voter-approved, open-ended, non-specified tax rate, that the General Assembly could always increase or decrease without future voter approval. Ms. Eubanks?
And I guess the way I see it is, in terms of the purpose of the initiatives being the establishment of a revenue stream to then be used for, you know, the variety of purposes that are set forth, depending on whether you're looking at 13 or 14. And the fact that in 13 they're allowing the rate, it's in 13 that allows the rate to be increased by the General Assembly without future voter approval. I mean, it relates to the provision of that revenue stream that for, if the General Assembly determined that for those purposes, and I think isn't 13 more general, that most of it's going to such purposes as the General Assembly may determine anyway, that the General Assembly could increase that revenue flow. Or, for example, and I think it's discussed a little bit in the fiscal note information that we got about severance tax, how the revenue stream is very uncertain. It fluctuates a lot. So, for example, if for whatever reason the revenue stream under this tax, new tax, decreased due to other circumstances, and in order just to maintain the same revenue stream, the General Assembly increased the tax. I mean, if that's the policy determination, that the General Assembly could do that. I mean, in terms of ensuring that the purpose of the measure is sort of making sure that this revenue stream is available for the purposes identified in the measure. And so, to me, the fact that it excludes any tax rate increases from voter approval in 13 is still related to the single purpose of providing a revenue stream for certain budget priorities. Whether that helps you or not, I don't know.
No, that does help me, and I think I'm coming around. I do think we need to make that aspect of this much clearer in the title, as Mr. Ramey, I think, hinted at. But it does seem to me that the people, if they choose to, should be allowed to create a tax that is essentially exempt
from Tabor. If they want to amend the Constitution in that way, I think they should, and I think that's what this does. My only real, my concern was, and it's related both to single subject and setting a clear title, you know, single subject is supposed to prevent confusion and surprises, and I just reading this the way it is, I think might surprise some people that they're exempting this completely from Tabor in the future. But I think we can resolve that by clarifying that in the title, and so as opposed to finding it a single subject violation. So I'm convinced on 13, and on 14, my concern there is a different one, and that has to do with the wide variety of uses the funding is directed to, and I think Mr. Ramey is correct that the main concern last year was with not only dedicating funds to a lot of different purposes, but essentially amending the statutes and that controlled how those funds were set up. My concern here is just whether we can legitimately say that taking a certain amount of money taken from oil and gas and dedicating it to capital construction education fund is really interrelated with the purpose of creating a new oil and gas severance tax system. As I read the Supreme Court's decisions, they do say there can be multiple purposes. They have to be interrelated. And just, I'm not sure that just the main purpose of bringing in more revenue or fixing the revenue system and spending that money automatically makes whatever you want to do with the money interrelated. So that's the only thing I'm concerned with on 14. As with 13, I'm not sure it's enough to prevent me from voting in favor of it, but I'd like to hear a little bit more discussion of why these wide variety of dedicated funds are fairly considered interrelated with the subject of creating an oil and gas severance tax system.
I don't know that I have a good answer, but I'll open my mouth anyway. So, in trying to figure out how to approach that question, I've been looking at sort of different permutations of this. I mean, if we had a revenue raising measure that said 100% of the increased revenue goes to a single purpose, it seems to me that's clearly a single subject. And maybe at the other extreme, if we had a revenue-raising measure that simply said all of the revenue goes to whatever purposes the General Assembly may decide, that still feels to me like a single subject, even though ultimately the General Assembly may allocate the revenue to many different purposes, but that wouldn't be separate and distinct purposes of the measure. So kind of in between, if you have a measure that says 25% goes to this purpose and then 75% to whatever purpose the General Assembly chooses, that's to me sort of like both of those extremes. And then if you have a measure that now getting more towards like number 14 where you allocate percentages for different purposes and then still have a final percentage as to whatever the General Assembly determines, I'm just not sure how to draw a line that says at some point in those different scenarios you cross the line and created multiple purposes. One of the tests is are there separate and distinct purposes, and I just can't glean that from this in the way that the either measure speaks to where the increased revenue should go, but I'm not sure. Ms. Eubanks?
And I don't know if my comments would be very helpful either. When I think of, and my memory isn't very good anymore, but it seems like we've set titles for measures that included sort of a laundry list or multiple purposes for which, if it was providing a new revenue source or an increased revenue source. And the one that came to mind most recently was what turned out to be Amendment 35, which was the new tobacco tax, because it had a variety of purposes for which that revenue was to be spent. Now, looking at the provision, most of those purposes were health-related in some way, but there was, you know, up to, I think it was 3%, goes to the general fund and to help offset the loss of cigarette tax revenues, because with a higher rate, the theory was people wouldn't be buying as many. So, I mean, it did have a little bit of a component of, say, going to the general fund. Sort of on the flip side of sort of multiple things listed, I also go back to many initiatives we saw with tax cuts that instead of, but it being a little bit different situation of not being where the revenues were spent, but giving tax relief. I mean, it was doing against, I don't know, income tax, property tax, sales taxes, motor vehicle excise taxes, utilities, a bunch of different types of tax relief. And numerous times, I think, the Supreme Court upheld the concept of tax cuts was a single subject. I mean, there were some other issues involved with some of the different versions we saw, but that a variety of tax cuts, it didn't have, you could only, you weren't going to be limited, proponents weren't going to be limited to doing one particular type of tax cut at a time, but you could lump them all together. And so I view this sort of the flip of that in terms of you're providing a revenue source, and I don't know that proponents are going to be limited, just you can only spend it on one purpose rather than multiple pet projects. I don't know if that helps or not.
No, it does. I mean, it seems to me we could adopt a number of, sorry to bore everyone with these theoretical discussions, although Mr. Ramey seemed to invite it, but it seems to me we could draw a line essentially saying if you're going to implement a tax, how those funds are directed is a different subject, and we're not going to allow that. I think that's too far, too strict. But another line we could, and the other thing we could do is say, if you're going to implement a new tax or raise a tax, then there's no limit on what you can do with the funds in the measure. You can create any kind of a system for using those funds that you want, which is 14 seems to me to be approaching that rule. And then the other one would seem to me to be to cut 14 off but allow 13 to go forward, which would be you can dedicate funds from a new tax or a tax increase, but you can only dedicate them to the extent that the purpose you're dedicating them to is somehow related to the tax that you're dealing with. And so that would seem to me to be a line that would be somewhat workable. And that would, I think, as you were saying, probably work with the tobacco tax with 13, but probably not with 14. On the other hand, I'm not sure that that really makes sense as a, I mean, it's appealing because it's some kind of a middle ground. But on the other hand, I'm not sure it is required by the single subject rule. I mean, raising money, as Mr. Ramey has said, is done not simply to tax somebody or to raise money for the fun of it, I hope. It's done to with some policy goal in mind, typically. And so the fact that here you're doing it with the policy goal of raising money for a number of different
things you want to fund. I think I'm beyond having a concern with that, and I think I'm willing to go along with the idea that dedicating funds, unless you get too deep down into the details of how you're going to restructure some education fund or the construction fund, that I think it's okay to just say we want more money to go to these things, even if they're not really related to the tax you're creating. So I think I'm moving my line a little bit in that direction far enough that I'm okay with 14.
I think we're at the point of a motion, and I would like to take them separately, number 13 and number 14. Is there a motion on number 13, Ms. Eubanks?
I would move on proposed initiative number 13 that it contains a single subject and that the board proceed with setting a title.
I'll second that. Any further discussion on number 13? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Let's go ahead and address number 14 as well. Eubanks?
I move that number 14 contains a single subject and that the board proceed with setting a title.
I'll second that motion. Any further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Then let's turn to the staff draft, and we'll I think we'll start with number 13. It's possible, depending on what we do with the staff draft, we could, they're so similar, we could end up using the amended version of number 13 to be a starting place for number 14, but we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. Ceci has put the staff draft for number 13 on the screen. Mr. Ramey, have you had an opportunity to look at the staff draft, and do you have any comments?
We have, and very few. I mean, it's a good draft. I'm sure Mr. Gallagher will. It's a good draft. Let me go immediately to the point that we were discussing on 13, and that is that it is not clear that we are intending, with regard to this new constitutionalized tax, to take the significant step of, I'll just call it, de-taborizing it. So this tax will not in any way whatsoever, and I want to emphasize that and underline it, be subject to Tabor. There is a phrase, and it is on line 5, that begins with the word subject to other constitutional provisions. Right, subject to other constitutional provisions or relating to tax increases. And actually, let me just read that in context. Starting up on midway through line 4, says permitting the General Assembly to increase the rate of the new severance tax subject to other constitutional provisions relating to tax increases. We would propose taking out the phrase subject to other constitutional provisions relating to tax increases, because we do not intend to be subject to any other constitutional provisions, namely Tabor, with regard to tax increases. So that is misleading. Now, if the board wishes to go further, I don't think we'd have an objection to it, but at a minimum, that one phrase is misleading.
So it should come out.
I think that phrase definitely should come out. And if the board wants to go further, and Mr. Domenico's nodding already, I don't think we would object to that, because, I mean, as you stated, it's within the subject of the tax we're creating, but I don't want to mislead anybody with the momentous nature, it's probably not the correct phrase, but the significant step that's being proposed with regard to this tax. So, I mean, it's an important step, and the voters need to know that.
So if the board were to drop that phrase but replace it with something like, without future voter approval or something affirmative, you would not object to that?
I don't think we would object to something like that. My clients, but I think that would be completely appropriate to do something like that.
Any other issues with the staff draft, Mr. Ingram?
Two others on 13. One is on line 2. It reads, amendment to the Commerce Constitution concerning the tax on oil and gas. We would propose inserting the phrase a tax on producers of oil and gas.
Repeat that. I'm sorry.
Sure. On line two, after the words, I'm going to actually start on line one reading it, an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning the tax on the producers of oil and gas. We would propose inserting the words the producers of. The reason for this is that this is a tax not at the gas pump at a gas station on gasoline. This is not a tax that somebody downstream in the flow of commerce pays, but this is a tax on the gross revenues available to producers. And we do think it's important, and it is now, and would be under this new tax. And we do think it's important that the voters be accurately apprised of who is going to pay this tax. They're not. Joe's Drugstore is not. It is now a tax on revenues paid to the producers. The third item, I don't know if there are any questions, but the third item is down at lines 10 and 11. And this, I just think, is an inaccuracy that appears in both 13 and 14 that arises out of the discussion that Ms. Eubanks and I had a little bit earlier this afternoon. Beginning on line 10, the words, which may reduce the amount of severance taxes paid and collected for taxable years commencing in 2007. Our goal is not to reduce the amount of severance taxes paid and collected for taxable years commencing in 2007, which means any part of 2007 that's part of a tax year that goes into 2008, per Ms. Eubanks in my discussion earlier. Those tax revenues would remain unchanged. Then there would be a change effectively increasing them effective January 1, 2008. So I think that phrase is just inaccurate. And that is all.
Any questions for Mr. Ramey? If not, let me hear from Mr. Gallagher, plus anybody else who may wish to comment on the staff drafts. Mr. Gallagher?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My concerns really relate to lines 11, 12, and 13 staff draft, and that is the treatment of or the explanation to the public about what happens with these revenues that are flowing from the elimination of the ad valorem tax credit. I think there are several problems with the draft as it exists right now. The beginning of line 12, the draft talks about certain revenues. I think it should be more specific as to certain revenues. We're talking about a some certain here, at least a percentage certain, 25%. So I think the voters should be apprised that fully a quarter of their revenues are going to be assigned. And then the next question or concern I have is advising the voters where this money is going to go. In the staff draft, voters are told that it goes to energy-impacted communities. That's not really a phrase that I think voters would understand. When you read that, it doesn't necessarily tell you who that's going to go to. And I think that is emblematic of a problem in the language of the initiative itself because, I'm talking about Initiative 13 in Section 5A. It says 25% of such revenues shall be appropriated and directly distributed to counties and municipalities socially or economically impacted by the development, processing, transportation, or energy conversion of non-renewable natural resources of oil and gas. The problematic language there is socially or economically impacted by the development, processing, and transportation. Now, there has been a suggestion by Mr. Ramey that there's a tie there between those communities and the communities that would be affected by the elimination of the ad valorem tax. I just don't see that there's a cause and effect there. I think there's an ambiguity in the language of the proposal, and because of the ambiguous language in the initiative, I think it's very difficult or impossible to set a title on that subject. and meaningfully explain to the people of Colorado which communities are going to get this revenue. I mean, is it going to be communities where oil and gas companies extract minerals from their community and therefore the oil and gas companies pay higher taxes? Is it going to be communities where the oil and gas companies reside? Is it going to be communities where the oil and gas is extracted? I just think that it is, because of the vague and ambiguous nature of the proposal, it's impossible for this this committee to set a title that adequately explains to the people where the money is going to go.
Questions, Mr. Domenico?
Well, we don't. We don't have to, in fact, we can't reject a measure simply because we don't know all the ramifications of how it will work out in practice, right? I mean, we can't vote against something simply because it includes some vague and ambiguous terms, can we?
No.
Right.
But if the vague and ambiguous nature of the proposal is such that you cannot properly set a title that apprises the people of the meaning of the initiative, that's another story.
Well, I agree with you that energy-impacted communities is not clear enough. It doesn't accurately reflect, give people enough of an idea of what's in the measure to be in the title, but I'm not quite convinced that it means we can't set a title at all. Seems to me we could pull some of the language out of the measure and make it more clear in the title what the measure actually says, even if we don't know, and then voters can take into account the fact that there are some vague and ambiguous terms. But I agree with you that energy-impacted community is adding an extra layer of ambiguity that we shouldn't do, but that's all.
I have a question for you, Mr. Gallagher, that changing subjects here, that I should have asked Mr. Ramey as well. The staff draft has a blank in the first line, and on behalf of the board, I'd ask Office of State Planning and Budgeting for an estimate, which I think was distributed, and I think everybody has a copy of the estimate from the Office of State Planning and Budgeting, which notes or estimates an incremental impact of $244.6 million. We will need to, in order to comply with Tabor, fill in that blank, I believe. And so I just wanted to solicit any comments that you have about the estimate and how the board should fill in the blank for the title.
Well, in all honesty, I have not reviewed the memo to the title-setting board relating to the fiscal analysis. So at this stage, I guess I would reserve my comments on that point, although I would note, obviously, that the blank would need to be filled in before the title-setting board would approve the title.
Sure. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Gallagher? Is there anybody else present who wishes to comment on the staff draft for number 13? If not, I'll turn to board discussion. Mr. Ramey. Yes, sir.
I'm not going to pick up on board. I don't think we would have an objection. I would note there's two things. With regard to the energy impacted communities, the current statutory application, I'm referring to Section 3929.110.1B.1, and there's no way you have it in front of you, I realize, but I'm going to quote the kind of language used there, shall be distributed to those political subdivisions socially or economically impacted by the development, processing, or energy conversion, et cetera. So the language is similar. If there is some more detail that the board would wish to put in there, I don't think we would have any difficulties with that at all. Again, what we are after is clarity. So we don't object to Mr. Gallagher's comments. Responding, Mr. Hobbs, to your comments about filling in the blank, I would defer to OSPB, of course. I do want to raise a couple questions, and I hate to invite discussion because I get it, but I invite it. But If I had to guess, the number's probably low, but I have no basis to stand on that. I mean, OSPB are the experts. I would note a query, and I'm not quite sure what to do with this, and I'll state my preference, but I'm not terribly energized about being overruled on this either. We are adopting a new tax. One could take the position that the number that should be placed in there is the entirety of the new tax, not just the incremental increase between the new constitutionalized tax and the old statutory tax. On the other hand, the way the language Tabor uses is, shall taxes be increased annually by? Well, the overall effect of what we're doing is eliminating one tax, creating a new one, and there's an incremental difference, which is the number, Mr. Hobbs, that you just cited. I think that is totally appropriate. Clearly, I'm comfortable in saying that there's no Supreme Court opinion on this issue, but I think probably proper interpretation of Tabor is to put the net incremental increase of eliminating one tax and adopting a new one, notwithstanding the fact that we're not amending an existing tax. But I think the argument could be made, this is a whole new tax, so you start from zero and put the whole thing in there. It would be useful to flesh the answer to that out. You know my preference. I think it's a question that the board should probably take a position on it. Sorry, Mr. Dinico, to do that to you again.
Could I ask, one other variation on the question of what number to fill in? Does it make any difference that number 13, allows the General Assembly to set a higher rate without future voter approval? Would there be any reason to put in a higher number, since in reality the voters could be approving a greater annual increase than that incremental amount listed by OSPB?
I don't think so, Mr. Hobbs, and correct me if I mistake this, but I think the Tabor requirement is to estimate as best you can the amount in the first year. And the first year it's going to be what we said to that. That's the practicality of it. It's going to be at 5%. And if the tax goes up, changes subsequent to that, I don't even know how you would address that. So the fact that we're giving the General Assembly the power to do that here without voter approval, and in 14 requiring voter approval, shouldn't change that number.
Okay. Thank you. Before we proceed, if there's anybody here who's waiting for the third agenda item, which was initiative number 9, the proponents have withdrawn that measure. So I just wanted to make that announcement in case anybody's waiting for that agenda item. So let me turn to board discussion on number 13 and find out if the board has suggested changes to the staff draft, and as we go through that.
Mr. Chairman, sorry, would it be possible for you to make an additional statement?
Yes. Sure. Mr. Gallagher, why don't you come forward? And I was also going to add that even though as we go through the changes to the staff draft, I expect that Mr. Gallagher and Mr. Ramey would be invited to comment as well. But go ahead, Mr. Gallagher.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I've now had an opportunity to review the memo that was provided by OSPB, and I am struck by OSPB's disclosure at their concern about their inability to really quantify the fiscal impact of the proposal. And this plays off of a question that you, Mr. Hobbs, actually raised, and that is, what number should go in that blank? I think it would be appropriate for the $428.3 million number, the larger number, to go in that blank, simply because we're reading a memo here from OSPB that basically tells us, since this is a new tax and a new calculation, and the way we're mixing apples and oranges, we can't quantify it very accurately. So I think that the safest thing to do would be to put in the larger of the numbers that's suggested by OSPB.
Thank you. Mr. Ramey, do you wish to comment, or I don't know if you have any comment on that one?
So. I think Mr. Gallagher and I posed that issue as well as can be posed, and I think it would be very helpful if the board would address it. We have different preferences, obviously, for probably a pair of reasons.
Okay, thank you. So let's turn to the staff draft again. And are there any changes suggested by board members to the staff draft? Ms. Eubanks?
Can we start with the language and not deal with the number till the end? I think. In terms of the suggestion that Mr. Rainey had on the statement of the single subject in the first phrase of the title, I do think it would be more accurate to talk about concerning the tax on producers of oil and gas extracted in the state, because it would be those individuals or companies that pay the tax on the gross proceeds from the oil and gas sold. And so I would suggest inserting after on, where Ceci has the cursor, to say producers of.
Is there, I'm sorry, can I comment on that or ask a question really? Is there any concern? I don't think the measure anywhere uses the word producers. I could be missing it, but I think some kind of revision is necessary. I'm just wondering if using that word doesn't assume something that may not quite be accurate.
Well, I guess you could say just the sale of. I mean, because that's really, it's the gross proceeds from the sale of the oil and gas extracted, rather than talking about who pays the tax, to just talk about the transaction that the tax is imposed.
So it would be an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning the tax on the sale of oil and gas extracted in the state. I think I would prefer that to producers.
I guess what question I'd raise is, do we need extraction and sale? Because we want, I think someone brought this up, we want to distinguish this from the tax at the pump. I mean, we're not, it's not on the, you know, paid by the people pumping gas.
Well, I agree with that, except the action part of the amendment, subsection 2, simply applies a tax to the gross income attributable to the sale of oil and gas severed from the earth in this state. And while the sort of subsection 1 preamble uses extraction, subsection 2 is just refers to the sale of oil and gas. And so I think if we use sale there, that
well, and we have the phrase extracted in the state. Was that still
I think that seems to me to mean the same thing as severed from the earth in this state. So I don't have a problem with that.
Okay. So the tax on the sale of oil and gas.
I think I would prefer that, just to avoid using kind of a what may be some sort of a term of art that's not in the measure itself.
Seems okay to me. What we have on the screen at this point is concerning the tax on the sale of oil and gas extracted in the state. And that's the expression, currently the expression of the single subject. Ms. Eubanks, would you like to move that?
I'll move that language on the screen.
I'll second it. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Ms. Eubanks?
In terms of the first phrase after in connection therewith, and this relates back to my questions to Mr. Ramey about sort of the timing of the imposition of the new tax. First of all, I'm not sure that the phrase as it appears in the draft right now is a very accurate description of or very helpful to folks. Plus, I think you have to work in a date. so that people know. And you can't really use taxable year because of the way the language is currently drafted in the measure. I think you have to just say that it's perhaps like 5% of the gross proceeds attributable on and after January 1st, 2008 from the sale of oil and gas extracted. I don't think that really gross proceeds from oil and gas extracted, again, it's that concept of there's the sale transaction that has to be worked in there. But I do think that we got to have the date in there, because otherwise the only date you have is way down with the repeal of the existing severance tax, and I just don't think that that gives voters enough notice as to when this new tax will be imposed if approved. So just to get us going, I think after the words gross proceeds there at the end of line 3, we'd insert attributable on or after January 1st, 2008, comma, on or after January 1st, comma, 2008, comma, and then after from, I would say the sale of gas extracted in the state. And I'd be interested to know if Mr. Ramey, what he thinks of that. It just seems like we need something in there about the timing. And it's very hard, because it's really going to be the income generated on and after that date, I think, that would be subject to the tax for the proceeds.
But the R and D. I think, yeah. I don't agree with that either.
An easier way, be my guest.
Yeah, I'm sorry to say it, but I can't do that. I don't think we would have any objection.
Or the other board members have ideas of how to better say it, that I'm open to them.
I might be confusing the issue here, but I'm wondering if it's possible, if there's any merit in combining this clause with the repeal language in lines 10 and 11. In other words, in this initial clause after the statement of single subjects, saying something like replacing the existing tax on oil and gas extracted in the state with a new severance tax, and this may be, I may be confused here, but a new severance tax is somewhere that I say effective January 1, 2008 at a rate of 5% of the gross proceeds, et cetera. And like I said, I may be confusing the date issue with my attempt to try to signal right up front that we're replacing one tax with another.
No, I think the dates are the same for both actions. So whether if we can consolidate it on...
That wouldn't mess up what you're trying to do?
No, if you want to... I think right now the draft is just done sort of sequentially as the provisions appear in the measure, and if we want to try to use that concept of replacement, I'm fine with that too.
Well, if I could make a run at that. So before the word... Well, I don't know, where the word establishing appears in line 3, I guess I would strike that and replace it with, and I'm just going to pick up language from 10 and 11, replacing, so the new language that I would insert would be replacing the existing tax on oil and gas extracted in the state with a new, well, with, in the state with, and then, I'm sorry, that a new is already there, so you could,
Need the replacing at the top, beginning of your phrase?
Oh, yeah.
Just at the beginning of what you have.
And I'm not
Maybe you just say effective January 1, 2008, replacing the existing tax.
Very beginning, effective January 1, 2008. So.
And I think you would drop some of the my new language there on line 5 about attributable on and after January 1st, 2008. I think you'd remove that. From the beginning of the line through 2008. I would argue that you still need the language, the sale of.
That first clause after the statement of the single subject now reads, and I say this partly just for the record, but now the working version is in connection therewith, effective January 1, 2008, replacing the existing tax on oil and gas extracted in the state with a new severance tax of 5% of the gross proceeds from the sale of oil and gas extracted in the state.
Suggestion I have there is if we're going to call it a severance tax in one place, it seems to me we should call it in both places. In the, so I don't know if we just remove severance from the middle of line 4 or add severance to existing severance tax. Seems to me a non-expert reader would be might find it confusing that one is a severance tax and one's not. And am I right that they're both severance taxes? That's, so I would either call them both severance taxes or just take severance out in one place in the line 4. I'm not sure which, if either is preferable.
I'm wondering if you know, to think that through, I mean, I agree with you, it's a little confusing, but I was also wondering if we were sort of segueing into the term severance tax. We, in the single subject, we refer to a tax on the sale of oil and gas extracted in the state, and maybe right from then on, maybe we can say severance tax.
We also have references to severance tax later in the staff draft.
Well, then maybe the way to do it would be in the I mean, maybe you call it replacing the existing severance tax with a new severance tax. I mean, is that what you were?
It's okay. And I think that's okay with me if it's. And then we do we not need them, you know, where we say existing severance tax, do we not need on oil and gas extracted in the state?
Well, you know, I think we might be able to get rid of that, but then it might be advisable to add it where we do use oil and gas extracted in the state, meaning in line 2, to add severance there, the severance tax on oil and gas, and then you might be able to get rid of all the oil and gas in the next few lines. But it, I think the first time you use severance, it should be with that, so you kind of make the connection.
I think that's a promising idea.
So I guess then maybe I'll just make the suggestion. In line 2, after the before tax, add severance. And then in line 4, get rid of everything after tax and before with that you've added.
After tax?
Right, so delete on. And then I don't know if we can get rid of it again in that, but probably not. Because we have to say what the gross proceeds of what.
I think you have, it's helpful to do it at least once.
Yeah. So I think I would leave
most people
that.
People may not even have a clue as to what a severance tax is.
So if we leave it that way, do you think that's.
Seems to work.
I think I'm okay with that.
Any comments about that from Mr. Ramey or Mr. Gallagher? And while we're at it, maybe can we strike then the clause down in lines 10 and 11 that says repealing the existing severance tax on oil and gas extracted from the state effective January 1, 2008?
And I think you'd want to continue to strike the language
yes.
that
yes.
Mr. Ramey had suggested all the way through 2007 on line 12. Yeah, because that's all the same phrase.
I'll move that change for the sake of further discussion.
Second.
Any other discussion that's been moved and seconded? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Further changes to the staff draft? Ms. Eubanks?
In terms of the language there now on line 6 that relates to the General Assembly increasing the rate of the new tax subject to other constitutional provisions. One, I think I agree with Mr. Ramey that the subject to other constitutional provisions is not an accurate statement for number 13. But in its place, what I would suggest is language reading something along the lines of without future voter approval. So that the voters have some notice that the General Assembly could increase the rate without future voter approval. So there on line 6, after tax, at the very beginning of the line, take the comma, that whole phrase down to the next semicolon, I guess. My opera glasses. So if you strike the current language about, and you want to go ahead and put the new language in? About however you want to do it.
Strike everything there to the semicolon.
Through increases semicolon down at the end of that line. Strike it all.
Yeah.
So from here to here.
Right.
Subject to increase.
And insert in its place without future voter approval.
After the semicolon?
No, before the semicolon.
Discussion about that change? Is there a motion?
I so move.
I'll second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0.
I think the only other suggestion I would have relates to the very last phrase of the title that's specifying how the revenues from the new tax are to be allocated. And I'm not sure what to do about the energy impacted communities issue right now. I agree that it probably should be more specific. I was concerned that the phrase didn't make any recognition to the remainder of the revenues being appropriated by the General Assembly, and the fact that Mr. Gallagher suggested perhaps instead of saying certain revenues, we could specify 25% or one-fourth of the revenues to be used for the energy-impacted communities. I think that's also a good idea. So I think my first change would be there on line 12 to strike the "and." I'm going to propose a new phrase after this, but and then on line 13, I would strike certain did we decide we're, every time we talk about the tax, we're going to call it the new severance tax? Is that?
I was going to suggest actually getting rid of "new" in that, just to avoid, I mean, I think in some ways that might add to some of the potential confusion about what the number should be in the first part, if we just, I mean, it's the whole tax and not just whatever's on top of the existing, and so I think if we just get rid of "new" there, that helps a little bit.
I mean, if we made it say something like requiring 25% of the tax revenues to be used to provide funding, do you think that would help simplify it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Ceci, right there we are, after we strike certain, why don't you insert 25% numerically? I know we've gone both ways, like with dollar amounts and all, so.
What's easiest to read, do you think?
To me, I think for the voters, numerically would be easier.
Okay, 2.5 with a percentage?
Percentage sign. Of the tax. Tax, yes. Just as you have it.
Okay.
And then after revenues, strike from the new severance tax to, strike the two, I think, required.
Then you'd have to put a that before 25.
So keep the two?
Yeah.
Keep the two. Okay, so if you can backtrack. Okay. Whatever's easiest. So for the time being, that would be my first suggestion.
And combine it with, since you struck the "and."
Okay, then there at the end of line 14, before the period, insert a semicolon, then insert "and allowing the remainder of the tax revenues to be appropriated." Appropriated by the General Assembly. I don't know.
What was that?
Should we capitalize General Assembly? Or is it usually, we tend not to capitalize much.
Maybe not.
Okay, so lowercase. I get confused what we do here versus what we do drafting.
Should it be the remainder of the revenues to be appropriated as determined? by the General Assembly?
The 25% is appropriated. It looks like it's 25% of such revenue shall be appropriated.
And 75% shall be appropriated as may be determined?
I'm trying to work in the idea that it's the other purposes.
Discretion.
Inserted as determined.
As determined. Appropriated as determined by the General Assembly.
No issues with that we haven't messed up in that part.
Okay.
That part's good.
So then the last... Well...
Basically, you're talking that it's requiring 25% of the tax revenues to be used to provide funding for energy-impacted communities, knowing that we may change that terminology, and allowing the remainder of the tax revenues to be appropriated as determined by the General Assembly.
So shall we stop there? And
I would so move the changes as reflected on the screen.
Second. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Well, so while we're on this clause, do we want to address the what we haven't touched on, what is now line 14, about how to describe the energy impact?
I'll make a few suggestions that we alter that to just try to more closely reflect the measure and just say something along the lines of, to be distributed to counties and municipalities, I don't know if we need socially or economically, just counties or municipalities impacted by I was considering saying impacted by the extraction of oil and gas, but it might be better to just say impacted by the development, processing, transportation, or energy conversion of oil and gas. I don't think we need to put in non-renewable natural resources, but the rest of it, it seems we might just best serve the purpose we're here for by just putting that whole, the rest of that language in there.
Try that.
So after 2B, I would strike the rest of that. All the way through communities, and I would replace it with distributed to counties and municipalities impacted by the development, processing, transportation, or energy conversion processing or energy conversion of oil and gas. I guess you need a couple of commas that maybe I'm missing because of the underlining. After development and processing.
staffs need transportation?
Did you, after development, which is right, there you go, didn't do it. And did we miss a word in there? Yeah, after processing, put transportation, comma.
Any discussion about that change? Is there a motion?
I'll move that we amend it to reflect that change.
I'll second. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Further changes to the staff draft?
We still have to deal with the number. And my personal feeling is that Tabor requires it to be the smaller number, the increase in taxes. But I wonder if there's a way we can incorporate somehow into this without missing Tabor's language, the serious uncertainty that the estimate has. I mean, I think we have to incorporate some uncertainty about that estimate, or we're not accurately reflecting. I mean, we're misleading people, and I'm just so I'm not sure. Maybe our lawyers can help us, but I'd like to. I think it's got to be the smaller number, but it's got to also reflect some uncertainty. So, if someone can help me figure out how to do that, I'd be grateful.
Mr. Rainey.
I mean, Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I might defer to Mr. Kneiser of all the people who toss the skunk down to him.
That's
but
a good idea.
The difficulty I think we have, Mr. Domenico, is what you said is absolutely an accurate concern. We have the language of Tabor, and here we have to comply with Tabor. The adoption of this provision is subject to Tabor. And the moment we start monkeying with the constitutional mandates of Tabor in the adoption of this provision, I think we enter a whole new arena of problems. And obviously, I don't want to go there. So I would implore the board, notwithstanding my sympathy with every word you just said, I would implore the board to comply strictly with the mandates of Tabor with regard to this. And I guess I would suggest that any concern with uncertainty is going to have to be addressed as part of the political process of passing it or defeating it.
Well, but
I don't know what else to do.
I agree. I don't want to. I think I don't want to. And I would vote against something that doesn't comply with what Tabor requires. But at the same time, we have the what I hope is not an irretrievably conflicting obligation to set a title that is accurate and doesn't mislead voters. So we have to come up with some way to comply with Tabor without giving people a false impression.
Well, I would guess one more caution to the board. Be careful the door you're opening, because there will always be some degree of uncertainty, not to the magnitude we have here, but some degree of uncertainty. And I swear every title board matter where we're going to be filling in a blank like this from now ad infinitum, we're going to live with what we do today. So I would just ask, well, Mr. Venigo, be careful.
No, I agree. And I'm wondering, is there a way to just simply say, state that it's some kind of an estimate without having to get too much into the details of it, which in this case, you're right, it's an even less definitive estimate than your typical, what will always be an uncertainty. But I'm not sure we can simply put a number in there and say that's good enough.
Mr. Gallagher? With all due respect, I think we're talking about a completely new tax here. It may be still called a severance tax, colloquially, but you're taking a tax out of the statutes, and you're imposing a new tax under the Constitution. That is a new tax. Just because it may be formulated in a way similar to a previous tax doesn't mean that you can sort of meld the two together. I think because it's a new tax, the $428.3 million figure needs to go in that blank spot.
But doesn't Tabor, I mean, the form required by Tabor is shall taxes be increased blank amount? And the increase, so I mean, I'm focusing on the word increase. If you simply put in the gross amount, that's not the amount of the increase in taxes.
Well, I guess it depends on how broadly you view tax increases. It is a new tax. And because the ad valorem tax is eliminated and because the statutory-based severance tax is eliminated, doesn't dilute the fact that there is a new $428 million tax going into play. And I think you start down a slippery slope again when you start saying, well, you know, we're eliminating this tax but and this credit, but we're imposing this tax, but that's all the same, you know, that's all the same tax. It is not. When you're replacing a statutory tax with a constitutional tax, that is a new tax.
And I'm belaboring the point here probably, but but the form is shall taxes, plural, be increased. I mean, it seems to me there could be multiple taxes. You could be eliminating some and adding some, but overall we're looking at taxes, plural. And that's a product of eliminating, even if you're correct, these are two separate taxes, you're eliminating one and creating another one, but what's asked for is the amount of the increase in taxes. Isn't that kind of a net effect?
I don't think there's anything in Tabor that suggests that it's a net. In fact, I think a literal reading of the amendment would be that you have to list each and every tax. So I think, you know, a strict reading of Tabor requires that if this is a new tax, it needs to be disclosed to the voters. And this is a new tax. And maybe you can further clarify that by indicating that there will be a change in revenue from other sources, the elimination of the ad valorem tax credit and the elimination of the severance tax that's based in the Colorado statutes. But there is a new tax being implemented in the Colorado Constitution, and I think that the fiscal impact of that needs to be disclosed to the voters.
So, I guess I'm still belaboring this, but if a measure eliminated a larger tax and replaced it with a smaller tax, would you fill in a blank with the amount of the smaller tax and not include any estimate? I mean, if there's a net decrease, you'd still say there was a tax increase? Shall taxes be increased?
Absolutely, but I think you can further explain it in the text of the title as to the fact that there's also a component that decreases taxes by amount greater than it's raised. But just because I'm cutting your taxes by $2 and raising it by $1, it doesn't mean I'm not raising it by $1. And I think that fact needs to be disclosed to the voters. And in this case, you're cutting your taxes by $1 and raising it by $2, so I think that fact clearly needs to be disclosed to the voters.
So you would have us, I mean, we all seem to agree, Tabor requires us to start with state taxes shall be increased and then put in some number. So you would have us put in the larger number there and then somewhere else put in decreased. I mean, I'm not sure how we would do that. I guess even if we agreed with you, there's got to be some, for the same reason as I've been talking about, to give the voters an accurate picture of what's happening. Somewhere in there, even if we accept your argument, we have to tell them that while taxes will be increased, they'll also be decreased. And so where would we put that?
But I think you could start with the language contained in the OSPB memo. I don't know that you quote from the final paragraph word for word from that the first two sentences, but I think you could include the substance of that in there, i.e., you're eliminating a statutory state tax, which generated X number of dollars in revenue. You are eliminating a ad valorem tax credit, which would add X number of dollars in revenue, and the net effect would be $244.6 million. So I think what you do is you comply with Tabor by advising the voters of the tax increase, and then you put it in context by telling them, by the way, we're eliminating the previously existing severance tax, and we're eliminating an ad valorem tax credit. In effect, $244 million. I, quite frankly, I think if you do anything but that, you run the very real risk that you fail to comply with Tabor by informing the voters of a, what is, by any definition, a $428 million tax increase. I mean, there may be other offsets which bring that amount down, but that is clearly a tax increase that the voters are expected to be voting for.
And I'm still having trouble seeing it that way. I mean, we've said we're replacing the existing severance tax with a new severance tax, and even that's almost too much for me. I think we're changing the severance tax. It seems to me that it's different, but it'd be misleading to treat this as two distinctly different taxes, like the sales tax and the income tax, or something like that. I mean, yes, we're making some changes in the rate and the credits and so forth, but it's still a severance tax. It's still the severance tax. And to me, it's misleading to say we're increasing it by the gross revenue from the new rate without the credit.
I'm not suggesting that you just include the $428 million figure without explaining the other effects. All I'm suggesting is I think Tabor requires you to disclose the $428 million figure in the blank, and then I think it is appropriate later on in the text of the title to explain what else is happening with the tax, with the severance tax and the ad valorem tax credit repeal. I mean, I think there is a conceptual difference, a significant difference of constitutional magnitude between a tax in the Colorado revised statutes and a tax that's imposed in the Colorado Constitution. They are not one and the same. And because you're replacing one with the other, I think Tabor mandates you disclose that.
And just to be clear, I think you're saying that if the tax rate were so low, and the new severance tax was so low that there was a net tax decrease, you would still say Tabor requires us to say shall taxes be increased. Is that correct?
I do, because it is a new tax. And you're imposing a tax credit, in your example, a tax credit that might be of greater magnitude than the actual tax, that doesn't mean you're not imposing the tax. And I think the voters of Colorado, certainly there would be a segment of voters who would say, yay for the credit, but nay for the tax. And I think that fact needs to be disclosed to the voters. That is a material fact that many voters would wish to know before considering this initiative. If you don't include that in the ballot title, that's something that many voters will simply never learn.
Ms. Eubanks?
I have a couple questions for Mr. Ramey. First of all, again, going back to my bad memory in last year, knowing that the severance taxes that were involved with your previous initiatives were an additional, my recollection is that they were severance taxes in addition to sort of the existing tax. It was sort of, it was not this type of proposal of getting rid of the statutory severance tax and replacing it with this tax. It was more an additional severance tax on top of, I mean, that's my recollection.
My memory is the same.
Okay, and I'm seeming to recall that with those types of measures, knowing that they're not exactly like this, but they did include the severance tax component, we set titles for some of them, and we had, I think, similar sorts of fiscal estimates, not number-wise, but in terms of recognizing the uncertainty of any sort of projections of severance tax revenues because of market conditions and all those sorts of things. Is that?
We did, and I can recall specifically getting one. I think it was at the very end of the line we got one OSPB estimate, and it was reflected volatility just as this year's.
But my recollection also is that whatever dollar amount they gave us, we put it in.
Yes.
Without any additional language about
yes.
The uncertainty about the estimate.
My recollection is that that is what was done.
My other question to you is understanding Mr. Gallagher's argument and understanding that if the lower amount, the 244.6, is inserted in the ballot title, that the ballot question will at least be susceptible to challenge on the basis that it should include the higher number. Are you comfortable with that risk?
I am, and I'll explain why. I mean, I think you're sort of damned if you do and damned if you don't with regard to this particular issue, and it's really courtesy of the Tabor language that we're living with. And Tabor is a constitutional mandate. It mandates specific words. It doesn't just mandate that certain concepts be disclosed. Those words are, shall taxes be increased with a certain amount to be filled in. And it's putting the net effect of what we are doing here is a tax increase. Overall state tax increase. I think Mr. Hobbs put it probably more eloquently than that particular concept. That is the net effect of what we're doing here. And if we say anything else in those first few words, remembering these words have to lead off. We can't stick them down in the middle somewhere. If we say anything else, I think we are misleading the public as to the net effect, the overall effect of this provision. Now, if we want to say something else down in between, you know, we could go on ad infinitum. Well, what we're really doing is repealing one tax and adopting a new one, and the new tax is in this amount, and the old tax is currently, and as we know, we can have all kinds of stuff in the title which would create their own problems. I'm not going to advocate that, but I think the worst thing that we could do is sort of bastardize the Tabor phrase, either by changing it or by putting a number in there that reflects in that first blank, which is only five or six words into the title, that reflects something other than the overall net effect of what we're doing. And the lower number does that. If you do anything else, I mean, I think we have a much greater problem with misleading.
Thank you.
Mr. Domenico, can I throw out as a suggestion, and this after annually, so we're okay with Tabor because that's where Tabor's requirements end, just putting in a clause that says, as estimated by the Office of State Planning and Budgeting or something like that. That doesn't quite reflect all the uncertainty here, but maybe that at least gives a hint to the voter. This is just a number that some state agency made up. You might want to look into it if you're concerned about the uncertainty, as opposed to this kind of very definitive number that the theoretical voter that I guess we're addressing in these things who comes in and reads that and says, well, I might be concerned if this had the possibility of really increasing taxes much, much more than this or of causing some kind of shortfall, but since it's going to raise 244.6 million annually, then I'm okay with that. I mean, if we can't incorporate some hint of the uncertainty here, I don't think I can vote to put this on the ballot. So I think we have to put some hint, and that seems to me to be the minimum we can do. It seems to comply with the technical requirements of Tabor because it starts after the quotes that Tabor requires. And I think I could justify voting for that. So that's sort of where I am.
Well, I'm troubled by doing that. I think, as Mr. Ramey said, I think we would, that would be the precedent we would always have to follow because it's, I mean, it seems to me Tabor requires a specific amount, even though we could, it's not a precise, it could, I don't think it could ever be a precise amount. I think we've had debates, the public has had debates about these estimates before, like referendum C and so forth. If they're just not precise, never will be. Tabor says to put in an amount, and I'm just reluctant to deviate from that, or from specifying a source, because we're not, there may be different sources we could draw upon, but...
Well, I think we should, I didn't mean to imply that we shouldn't put the number in there. Right. I think we should put the number in there, and while Mr. Gallagher's argument is an interesting one and sounds like we may get some guidance on it from the court, I'm not quite persuaded by it. But adding that language after annually, Tabor doesn't specify what has to come after annually. I think, in fact, in my opinion, it's a good precedent to set to acknowledge some uncertainty in these instances. And I think if we draw those estimates from different places and we, I mean, I might be convinced to not specify where the amendment comes from, but I don't see why it's a bad thing to do so. Because then the voters can at least say, well, why, I want to see where that, what that says. And then they might actually go look at this, or they might get more involved if they're actually interested. So, I think those are
reasons
to vote or to put that statement in there, personally.
Ms. Eubanks?
I think I'm agreeing with Mr. Hobbs, and I'll explain why. Mr. Domenico, I understand your concern. I think that Tabor itself provides, I mean, what, in terms of the nature, the purpose of having the number there, the reason that Tabor requires a number to be stated is that Tabor requires that if, for example, more revenue comes in that exceeds the amount that's stated in the ballot title, Tabor says that that excess amount has to be refunded. So the whole point is that that's sort of the maximum amount of revenue that the state can keep. I mean, even Tabor itself, if you look at that language, that's what in 3C, it refers to it as an estimate. I mean, every number is an estimate. Now, and I won't speak for Mr. Bruce, but I've heard him make the argument that you know, to avoid the problem of underestimating the effect of a proposed tax increase, for example, you up the amount high so that you don't get in the situation of generating more revenue than what you've stated in your ballot question, because otherwise you have to refund it. Now, of course, the flip side of that is the higher the number,
right,
perhaps the less likely voters are going to approve it. But the nature of the beast is that the number is there that caps the amount of revenue that could be generated by this particular tax increase. And so the fact that there's uncertainty, if it comes in lower, then they obviously don't get as much revenue as they thought they were. If it comes in higher, they aren't going to be able to keep the higher amount. So it sort of protects the taxpayers, and I think that's the way Tabor, why it was structured that way.
I agree completely, and I'm reluctant to disagree with you on Tabor-related issues.
Please do.
My concern about this is not driven at all by Tabor. It's driven by our obligation to set titles that accurately inform the public what is going on. And so Tabor causes us problems because we have to follow this language. But I want to follow both Tabor and our fundamental obligation to set a title that doesn't mislead the public. And so it seems to me we can do both by just putting in a statement after Tabor's required language that acknowledges that the number we put in there is somewhat uncertain. I would propose putting in where we came up with the number so a voter can, if he for some reason deeply distrusts that state, he can that state agency, he can discount it as taken. I mean, unless you see that, adding that language after that as and maybe this is what you were getting at and I missed it. Do you think that adding that language after annually somehow would cause a problem with Tabor's requirement that that number be calculated in? Because if not, then I really think we need to do something like this. I mean, I'm not going to vote for it unless we do, and I think.
And if I could just respond, no, I don't think that adding the language would constitute somehow violating the mandatory ballot language of Tabor. I think this is separate and apart from that. I think what's at issue is basically, I mean, no one has a crystal ball, and whether it's in this context, whether it's the fiscal impact of any legislation being considered by the General Assembly, for any ballot measure that the General Assembly may refer, I mean, you basically have to go with the best information that you have. I mean, and what we have from OSPB is the best information that we have right now. Understanding the uncertainty regarding the tax, the market factors, the whole bit, there's only so much we can do, just like we've seen revenue forecasts. And Mr. Hobbs was alluding to the forecasts that were made in terms of the estimates for referendum C and how much people were saying how much in excess of the state spending limit there was going to be, and then there's a whole lot more. I mean, in terms of coming up with these estimates, that's all they are. I mean, even back prior to Tabor, when the title board was actually including fiscal statements, the format of our, we had to actually do a summary. In addition to doing the title, we had so much fun doing sort of a summary and a fiscal impact of each measure that, again, it all includes sort of estimates, and it's sort of, you know, the best information available. I think the information that we have from OSPB is the best available information at this moment, and that we go with that. I just, as a matter of policy, I would disagree with you in terms of needing to say that this is based on OSPB's estimate. I mean, if someone wants to find that out, I mean, most people won't even know what the Office of State Planning and Budget is. I mean, it's just, I don't know that it's very helpful. If they really want to find out the source, they're going to come back to the records of the title board to find out where that number came from. And so I just don't know that adding it really helps the voters understand that it's an estimate or what the number was based on. I think I just disagree with you in terms of the matter of policy.
And I agree with Ms. Eubanks. I mean, I really do appreciate, Mr. Domenico, where you're coming from. And I, you know, I'm just reluctant to deviate from the practice. I'm concerned. I have multiple concerns about deviating from sort of the strict practice here. I mean, one of my concerns is that although we ask OSPB for an estimate, and it seemed like usually, and recently I think we've gone by that, there's nothing that binds us to that. And proponents and opponents can come in with their own estimates and their own analysis, and the board could come up with its own based on a composite of different estimates. And so, for example, I'm reluctant to start citing our sources. To me, it's a given that it's an approximation, and I realize in a way it's, I mean, to me it's a given, even though I think partly where you're coming from, Mr. Domenico, is that it just doesn't say that. It makes it look like a precise figure, but the Tabor says that. I mean, it says, it doesn't say shall taxes be increased by, you know, approximately so much annually. It's as if there were an ascertainable amount. And I am inclined at this point just to comply strictly with Tabor.
Well, I understand that. And I think the reason Ms. Eubanks explained why Tabor has that strict language, because originally, if you don't opt out of the revenue limit and you go over that number right, then it's got to be refunded. But I think we still are complying strictly with Tabor by adding something after annually that states that makes it clear this is an estimate and makes it clear where it came from. I mean, if it came from the proponents, it should say it came from the proponents. I'm not sure I see the downside to doing so, since we're complying strictly with Tabor. And on the other hand, I think by not doing so, we're not complying with our obligation to. I mean, and I understand the idea that everyone knows these are estimates, but I'm not sure I agree with that understanding of the public's reading of these things. And so I think it's misleading without something in there.
Well, I don't know. Again, maybe this is getting the discussion too far, but I don't think, say that it's from OSPB. I mean, I accept responsibility on the part of the board that this is really it's up to us to accept estimates and put them into the title. And if I believe it's a reasonable estimate, then I don't want to attribute it to somebody else. I want to attribute it, everything in the title, including the estimate, to the board, frankly, unless I have some reason to disagree with it. And I can foresee a situation where we may feel that the estimate is too low or too high. But ultimately, it's the board's estimate of the amount that Tabor requires to be in the
estimate. Maybe we should say that. I mean, I don't want to throw somebody else under the bus. Maybe we should say as estimated by the title setting review board. Does it make any sense for me to make a motion that is clearly futile, or should I just move on?
I mean, my preference is still to fill in the blank with the best number we have so far, which I think is the incremental increase. I mean, we've heard several different views here about whether we should say estimate or whether we should show the amount of the new tax and so forth, but that's still where I am. And I don't know, whatever motion would get a second and two votes. So, Banks, I don't know. I mean, I would just fill in the blanks with the 244.6 million. But.
And I think that's where I am, although I would like to at least state my reasons for why I think that's the correct number. I think that in terms of the arguments that have been made, whether it's the larger sort of gross number or the net number, I think that what Tabor is intended to do is to give notice and voters an opportunity to vote on increases in tax burden. And since the larger number, the 428.3, includes an amount that would be equal to what's currently being paid with the existing severance tax, I don't believe that portion would be an increase in a tax burden. It's only going to be the incremental impact of this tax in terms of replacing the existing tax with the new in terms of an increase in a tax burden, because that other portion is still, it's an existing burden. It's not an increase in my mind, and that's why I think that the 244.6 million would be the appropriate number.
I will just, based on what I've heard, to get us off the dime, I'll go ahead and move that the staff draft be amended in line one, replacing the blank with dollar sign
244.6 million written out in word in a word. I still think, you know, sometimes I'm slow to come around, and so maybe, Mr. Domenico, I might yet come to your position, but not there yet, but that would be my motion, just to say state taxes shall be increased by $244.6 million annually, et cetera.
Okay.
That's moved and seconded. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no.
No.
That motion carries 2-1. Are there further suggested changes to the staff draft?
Let me just clarify my position. I don't object to that change, filling in the blank in that way. I would further amend that by adding after annually some notation that this is an estimate, and if it either by the OSPB or by the title board, I would amend it that way. That's why I voted no.
Okay. If there are no other suggested changes to the staff draft, is there a motion to adopt the title as amended by the board, with the understanding that the changes made in what is now lines 1 through 12 would also be made in lines 12 through the end, whatever that is.
Yeah, in terms of the ballot title and
submission process. Thank you. Thank you.
Sorry, I was
very tired.
I understand. I would so move.
I'll second that. If there's no other discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no.
No.
That motion carries 2-1. That concludes title setting on number 13. The time is 4:33. And I'd suggest we go on to number 14 using this version as the basis for number 14. If you want to be sure to save that one for 13. And wasn't paying a lot of attention, but I think what Ms. Gomez is doing is putting this, what we adopted for number 13, on the screen as our working draft for number 14. And there are some, I think there are some differences, but that would be a starting place. Ramey, would you like to comment on what is now our working draft for number 14?
I think we've done most of the work, fortunately. I think there are three things. I'm just going to accept otherwise. I'm not going to quibble with anything that was done with regard to 13. Except, first off, the phrase subject to other constitutional provisions relating to tax increases that was on line 5, I think, needs to go back in to this in lieu of the... without future voter approval on line 6. So going along line 5, to increase the rate of the new severance tax instead of without future voter approval, this one would say subject to other constitutional provisions relating to tax increases.
Ms. Eubanks?
Mr. Ramey, about that, and this is just a question in terms of the language you're suggesting to be put back in, do you think that that's very helpful to the voters. I mean, yeah, I know what this provision means, but I don't know that it means a lot to other people. And so I just want your take. Perhaps you say something like subject to future voter approval. I mean, because this is, I mean, I think that might be more meaningful to voters rather than just saying subject to other constitutional provisions relating to tax increases. I mean,
because you guys, I think that's a good point. I was just putting back in the staff draft.
I mean, I agree that it's an important notion, but I would just suggest maybe a different approach.
I like yours better. Great.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, please do. That's okay. I actually do like your language better, and I think it would mean more to the voters than the staff draft language. That is that change, however you want to do it, is one. Number two is, where is that permitting language? Line seven, in the middle, starting with the words permitting the General Assembly to enact an exemption for mineral producing oil and gas wells. That is not present in 14, so that should come out. And finally, we have different uses at the end, so we got to bring back in the purposes for which money will be spent from the original draft of staff draft of 14, subject to any changes. Like to make spy on those.
Thank you.
Everything else, I think, is the same.
Thank you. Then, Mr. Gallagher. Was there another?
We were just looking. The 25%
of the bottom, obviously, is going to be different. But that's right. Justification.
Yes.
Well, the good news is we've been going at this so long, my leg is almost healed. I guess for brevity's sake, I will adopt the comments for Initiative 14 that I made for Initiative 13. With one point of emphasis, and that is with regard to the language in the last couple of lines that informs voters where the proceeds are going to be allocated, I think we have to be specific as to the percentages. So that'll be a modification based upon the staff draft. And if we include 25% of the tax revenues going to counties and municipalities, I think we have to include the percentages for the other earmarked buckets as well.
And I'm in my own mind, I'm trying to think that through, that I recognize whereas in number 13 we were quite specific about the one specific purpose, I'm just wondering if that really does create the need, likewise in number 14, to enumerate each specific purpose, or given that there's a bunch of relatively small percentages, do we really have to enumerate all of them? You know, I'm just thinking that through. I mean, how important is it to tell the voters every single allocation that's made before you get to the percentage that the General Assembly can appropriate on its own?
Well, of course, I'm the guy that thinks the whole deal violates the single subject rule for exactly that reason. So I do think it's important to inform the public. I mean, even though we may be talking about relatively small percentages, we're talking about relatively small percentages of millions and millions of dollars. And it certainly is a material amount of funding that's going to be sources.
Mr. Domenico.
Would it alleviate your concern on that at all to, instead of specifying each percentage, state before you start listing them, requiring certain percentages of the revenues from the tax to go to blah, blah, blah. And so then you're at least saying not just that it requires some of the money to go to each of these things, but that it sets certain percentages for each of them. Does that get you any closer to happy?
I don't think it does. And put yourself in the position of a voter who may have a particular, I hate to say agenda because that carries some baggage with it, but a particular interest, education funding. They want money to go to education. I think a voter that looks at this ballot title, who is interested in education, would be interested in knowing that 15% of the revenues in Proposal 14 go to education funding, as opposed to 23% going to capital construction. I think for a voter that has a particular interest, that's a material issue, that capital construction is being elevated above education. So I think it's imperative that you inform voters of the percentage distribution in the ballot title.
Thank you. Discussion by the board.
Ms. Eubank.
Can I ask Mr. Ramey one question?
Mr. Ramey.
And this goes back to the itemized list as it appeared in the staff draft for 14, because I think that some of the terminology might need to be clarified, but I wanted to run them by you to see what you thought. One of my concerns was where it made the reference to school capital expenditures. I don't know that that's very meaningful to most people, whether, one, it would be helpful to at least reference to school district, so people have the concept of it's school district capital construction rather than, say, higher education, and also to change capital expenditures to capital construction, because that's really, I mean, it's sort of a bricks-and-mortar concept. On the reference to public education, maybe to insert elementary and secondary between public and education, just because, again, to distinguish between K-12 versus higher ed. Do you have any feel for those types of...
I would endorse everything you just said.
Okay.
I think those are excellent. Particularly the construction, because capital expenditures means nothing to me.
Yeah.
Capital construction means a lot to me. So.
All right. Thank you.
Any discussion by the board or changes to the staff or to the working draft on the screen? Eubank,
I'd be happy to do the easy stuff. We'll at least get that out of the way, and then we can deal with, I think, the more problematic issue is the designation of the purposes for which the revenues are spent. I would first suggest there on line 6, striking without and inserting subject to.
That's a motion.
I would so move.
I'll second. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Ms. Eubanks?
Then I would, I believe it begins on line 7, the language permitting the General Assembly to strike, the language permitting the General Assembly to enact an exemption for minimal producing oil and gas wells, semicolon. Take out that whole phrase.
Second. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Ms. Eubanks. Thank you.
It's not fair. I have to go back to the Capitol after this. They'll still be going. I'm torn. I think in general our practice has not been to do an itemized list of all the various purposes that a particular measure might be funding. And so I'm really adverse to doing that in this instance, even though understanding what we did with 13. But the fact is that you had only sort of two purposes and really only one specific purpose to mention in 13, whereas here you've got 1, 2, 3, 4 specific and then the sort of catch-all. I think I'm more inclined to do something along the lines of what was in the original staff draft for number 14. And I think what I would suggest is striking on line 10 the 25%
and substituting specified percentages and then after distributed insert for school district capital construction comma public elementary and secondary education comma state capital construction stuck with the four and the two. Maybe we go ahead and strike the, put a comma after construction, strike the two, I think to be distributed four counties and municipalities, all that language, then down on line 13. Since this one has a specified percentage for the GA's share, which I think is 23%, 24%, whether or not we shouldn't have sort of the remainder language. I mean, it is the remainder, but since it did, it sort of fits in with the specified percentages.
Can I make a suggestion?
Please help me.
Well, one way to get a little closer to addressing Mr. Gallagher's point without putting in percentages would be to list things in order of the percentages, at least. This is not quite in order, I don't think. And that might give people an idea of how it's prioritized in here. And then we still have the issue of how to deal with the 24% to the General Assembly, but it might...
So, for example, the reference to the General Assembly would come first because
right.
it's the largest percentage.
Yeah. And maybe it would be...
Could you still put it last under the theory that it could be that could be
that's
broken out in a small percentage?
I mean, oh.
Because I was sort of trying to get... I'm wondering if we can get... I'm not quite sure how to do it, but just say, and for such other purposes as may be specified by the General Assembly or something like that. Have this specific.
Well, can you, if you just put it in order, and then left it, the General Assembly left the remainder language, because that's essentially what it is, right? 24% is just the remainder. Would that work? And then what order would it be in? There's two 23s, so we have to flip a coin or something. There's the counties and municipalities
and the capital
construction are both 23. And then two 15s. So I don't know if that helps any, but at least it gives people an idea. To some extent, I think putting it out of order without percentages is a little misleading, and so I would think at least we should do it in some kind of order of percentages. If we're not going to put in percentages themselves, of course, I'm going to have to vote against it anyway. So I don't know, maybe I should just be quiet.
I like the idea of arranging it in some order. although I think I'd at this point still prefer listing the things that it is distributed for. I'd still prefer it, at the very last item, be such other purposes as the General Assembly may determine as kind of a miscellaneous category. But within the list, if we can just arrange it, rearrange it, what we've got, I think that'd be fine.
Well, what if we just did the, I mean, the first 23 listed as the capital construction, and then counties and municipalities, and then state education fund, or however we're referring to that, and
you cut and paste, Ms. Gomez?
So you want me to take counties and municipalities and put it away?
Well, let's see. First should be
by the General Assembly.
Well, I think.
Or you were going to do that.
I'm okay leaving that as kind of the remainder of.
Okay.
So the first would be the capital construction reserve, which is
school district capital construction.
So that's
okay.
That's okay leaving that first. So yeah, then move counties and municipalities to right there after that, comma, state education fund, which is public.
Do we need to specify what counties, do we need the rest of the language?
The rest of that I would put in there.
About
the impact, all the way, impacted all the way down to oil and gas.
Yeah, sorry.
And put that after municipalities. You have two commas now, but a comma would go there.
If we go with the concept of the sort of using the remainder to the GA, do we need an and after education, comma, and before state capital construction? Because if those are sort of the things
mm-hmm.
in the series for the percentages.
But I was going to try to avoid that, but maybe that's
okay,
the better approach. But my approach to avoid it is just to
say those and make it all one phrase?
Yeah, it's for a bunch of things, and the last thing would be for such other purposes as determined by the General Assembly.
How about it?
Is that okay?
So it was the way.
Oh, I'll try. State, let's see. So with the last item so far is state capital construction. Then, that's comma and then and. Strike beginning with allowing. Through the word appropriated. Insert such other purposes. As, does that work? Another changing subject here slightly is that it's a hard clause to read, and I don't know. The only thing I can think of doing as far as helping is to insert numbers or letters to keep the list separate. I mean, I sort of get lost.
We've done that.
I think we have. If we were to do it here, it'd be distributed for like paren one. School district capital construction, comma, paren 2, counties and municipalities, etc. Would that be helpful?
It would.
Let's try that. So, end of line 10, before school,
insert paren 1, close paren. Numeral 1, the number 1. After district capital construction, comma, insert 2, paren 2. Line 12, right there, paren 3.
I so move the changes on the last phrases as reflected on the screen.
Second. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Guess I'll do the painful part.
Well, I really hate to do this, but the language about exempting taxpayers with less than $300,000 of gross income, is it clear enough to everybody that that only refers to income from this activity? That's the way I read the measure, right? It doesn't, if you have other income, it doesn't go towards that exemption.
Well, now I sort of wonder whether it should be proceeds, because we used gross proceeds earlier. I'm not sure we were consistent, which then raises the question on 13, whether we've got inconsistent terminology. I think if it said proceeds, I think it might make it clearer, the concept when we talk about the rate of the tax, but rather than this being an income tax or something along those lines.
I'm no tax expert. Is there a difference between gross proceeds and gross income? Because if there's not, I would think that would be a helpful change to make.
I don't know. I mean, I'm looking at the current severance tax on oil and gas, and it's in terms of gross income. So in terms of the measure itself,
it refers to gross income attributable to the sale of oil and gas, which I'd rather not lard this thing up with that. It may be clear enough that this is a tax about certain kinds of income, and it's not...
Well, since your single subject identifies it as severance tax on the sale of oil and gas extracted in the state, I think you have a pretty good argument that people should understand that you're dealing with severance tax and not state income tax, for example, but a lot of people won't know what a severance tax is.
Right, and I'm not sure how that would really mislead anyone anyway. I mean, I guess they could assume, I don't know. I just wanted to point that out, that it's not necessarily the same thing.
But now I'm wondering whether the reference to gross proceeds on line 4
actually incorrect and should say gross income. Perhaps the same change being made to the title we set on 13. I would move that change on line okay. 4 to change it from gross proceeds to gross income.
Second that. Now, second. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. We may reopen number 13 if we want to go back to that. But Banks?
I would move the staff draft as it is shown amended on the screen.
I'll second that. Any further discussion?
I'll just state again that I'm unfortunately going to have to vote against it for the limited reason that I expressed at length earlier.
Thank you. No other discussion, then all those in favor. I hate to do this, but I think I should have, on number 13, read this into the record since we see what's on the screen, but I feel like that's important. So the motion would be that the title would read as follows. State taxes shall be increased by $244.6 million annually by an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning the severance tax on the sale of oil and gas extracted in the state, in connection therewith, effective January 1, 2008, replacing the existing severance tax with a new severance tax of 5% of the gross income from the sale of oil and gas extracted in the state, permitting the General Assembly to increase the rate of the new severance tax subject to future voter approval, exempting taxpayers with less than $300,000 of gross income from the tax, prohibiting a credit against the tax for property taxes paid, exempting revenues from the tax from state and local government spending limits, requiring specified percentages of the tax revenue to be distributed for, school district capital construction, counties and municipalities impacted by the development, processing, transportation, or energy conversion of oil and gas, public elementary and secondary education, state capital construction, such other purposes as determined by the General Assembly, with the understanding that the same changes would be made at the ballot title and submission clause. Mr. Domenico.
Is it any concern having the dollar sign in line 1 and the words written out in line 6?
It does seem inconsistent.
I mean,
maybe we should change the 300,000 to, again, if our theory is that it's easier to read numbers.
The only theory I have to go on is personal experience, and I find a dollar sign and some numbers easier to read than words. So I would move that the words $300,000 in line 6 be stricken and replaced with a dollar sign 300,000.
I'll second that. I think I'll consider that just a friendly amendment to the motion. I think we had a motion to adopt the draft as amended. Any further discussion? I need to vote. We need to vote on that. I seconded that. All those in favor of that change, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Then we're back to the main motion to adopt the titles as amended. If there's no other discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
That motion carries 2-1. That concludes action on number 14. The time is 5:06. I would move for reconsideration of number 13 for the purpose of making corresponding changes to number 13.
I'll second that.
And all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. We're going to go back to what we adopted on number 13, and I think there's a couple of changes then that we would make.
I think one would be the change of gross proceeds to gross income on line 4.
I move that that change be made.
I second that.
That's been moved and seconded. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Then change the $300,000 in words to numbers. I'll move that change.
Second.
That's been moved and seconded. If there's no other discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. And I would move to readopt the titles as amended. And this time I will end up reading it into the record. Ms. Eubanks, would you like to second that motion?
I would second.
So the title for number 13 then would read as follows. State taxes shall be increased by $244.6 million annually by an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning the severance tax on the sale of oil and gas extracted in the state, and in connection therewith, effective January 1, 2008, replacing the existing severance tax with a new severance tax of 5% of the gross income from the sale of oil and gas extracted in the state, permitting the General Assembly to increase the rate of the new severance tax without future voter approval, exempting taxpayers with less than $300,000 of gross income from the tax, permitting the General Assembly to enact an exemption for minimal producing oil and gas wells, prohibiting a credit against the tax for property taxes paid, exempting revenues from the tax from state and local government spending limits, requiring 2.5% of the tax revenues to be distributed to counties and municipalities impacted by the development, processing, transportation, or energy conversion of oil and gas, and allowing the remainder of the tax revenues to be appropriated as determined by the General Assembly, period. I think the motion before us is to readopt the titles for number 13. That's been seconded. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
That motion carries 2-1. And that then concludes action on number 13. The time is 5:10 p.m. As indicated earlier, the other agenda item, number 9, was withdrawn by the proponents. That concludes our agenda. The time is 5:10 p.m. Thank you.